short text, presumably the first words Moses read when he brought the tablets down from Mount Sinai. "I am the Lord thy God," God wrote. "Thou shalt have no other gods before me. One Lord, thy God, have no other." Since we were last together, baseball fans commemorated a loss. Bobby Thompson died. Bobby Thompson played left field for the New York Giants and has something of a famous note in history, baseball history. He hit the home run that won for the Giants, the New York Giants, the pennant in 1951 against the hated Brooklyn Dodgers. An unlikely event because in August of that year, the Brooklyn Dodgers were 10 games ahead of the Giants, and the Giants caught them, and on the last day in the ninth inning, two runs behind, Bobby Thompson hit a three-run homer, and the radio call by Russ Hodges is immortal. A long fly ball. The Giants won the pennant. The Giants won the pennant. The Giants won the pennant. Everybody's heard it. Through an odd set of coincidence and circumstance, has everybody heard that? What a lot of people don't know is that there was no official record of the audio of that home run call. Nothing was recorded. We have some video from the television feed and the television announcer and the radio announcer for the Dodgers. Not very exciting. A young 12-year-old New York Giants fan who knew he could not be home in time to hear the end of the game because it was an afternoon game, asked his mother to turn on an old reel-to-reel tape recorder for the ninth inning of that game. And it is the only known recording we have of Russ Hodges saying the Giants won the pennant. A few days later, the kid wrote to Russ Hodges and said, "You want a copy of that?" And he said, "Of course." And then the New York Giants made that a record and made it a premium for their fans and executives and so on. But we only have that arguably most famous audio piece of baseball history by circumstance and happenstance, and it's the only one. Simpler days they were in 1951. Better days in some ways, not so much in others. But when we only have one record of what occurred, we're pretty sure that that's what happened. These days, I can't imagine a baseball game or any other social or public event that would not be recorded from 10 or 12 different angles, much less our ordinary lives, that if they're not under surveillance from a camera somewhere, certainly are subject to being recorded on video from somebody's cell phone and 90 seconds later appear on YouTube and the internet. We are in an age where information is ubiquitous, which means information is subject to interpretation. There's always, it seems, many, many more than one record of virtually everything that is occurring, which means that information, be it a political speech or a rally or an event or a sporting event, is packaged in many of several different ways, to some advantage and some not. Glenn Beck and Al Sharpton have very different views of the meaning of Martin Luther King's "I Have a Dream" speech, and the tension and contention that goes with, I think what that symbolizes more than the details of that particular event, characterize our lives. News reported this week that the midterm elections coming up in November promise to be the most tense and contentious of all time, because we see it this way, you see it that way, and both of you are wrong and both of you are right and we're going to fight about it, etc. Anger seems to be the result of a glut of information. The Academy Award-winning movie in 1980 was Ordinary People. It starred Donald Sutherland and Timothy Hutton and Mary Tyler Moore and Judd Hirsch. An angry movie in many ways, the subtle anger that characterized ordinary people in an American family. The key character was played by Timothy Hutton, a teenage boy at the time, an angry teenage boy over issues related to who his parents were and how they related to him and the loss of his older brother. Anger and tension so strong in his life that he found himself in a psychiatrist's office, during which the sessions were characterized by a great deal of silence, angry silence. Until finally the kid can't stand it anymore and said, I just wish I had some control. To which the psychiatrist, played by Judd Hirsch, quietly says, I'm not big on control. I'm not big on control. Anger is an effort to seize control. One of the more interesting books I read in my training was a book called Facing Anger, in which the insight came out, when we're angry, we are choosing to feel that instead of to feel something even more frightening like powerlessness or fear. Anger is a safer feeling than to feel out of control. And yet, the psychiatrist says, metaphorically to all of us, I'm not big on control. That doesn't help. Because there are so many things we cannot control. And I would suggest that the reason the first commandment is what it is, thou shalt have no other gods before me, is because we live with the seductive illusion of control that can become the center of our lives. It may be the most destructive false god we have, the illusion of control. A choice to feel in the face of what occurs, anger or powerlessness. What's it like to feel powerless? It's frightening. Why should we do so? Well, it seems to me that when we realize there are so many things we cannot control, we can choose to respond to what's out of our control in helpful ways. Once we realize that we're more or less all in the same boat together, that there's so very little about our lives about which we can be absolutely sure and completely in control of, it might make us a little more tolerant, even of ideas or circumstances that are different from where we come from. It might evoke in us a sense of compassion, perhaps, which I think is much different than pity. Pity looking at somebody else's life and saying, how sorry is that? But rather compassion, the frightening understanding that there is nothing that can happen in anyone else's life that couldn't happen to us. We cannot predict the convergence of time or circumstance. And it might make us a little more understanding, tolerant, and compassionate, even for those people, or even for those ideas about which we disagree and differ. I'm not big on control. Rather, God might be saying, I'm big on the stewardship of tolerance and compassion. One of the key insights of the 20th century came after Dr. Bob Smith and Bill Wilson came together and formed what we now know as Alcoholics Anonymous, but more dramatically, the process of 12-step living. The first step being half the distance, saying essentially, I am powerless. The second step saying, there is a higher power that can restore us and keep us well. That's a pretty tough road to hoe for control freaks. But there is a higher power. We spent a week looking at the Gulf of Mexico. The Gulf of Mexico has been wounded. It has been wounded because we depend on oil for our lifestyle and we can't predict the convergence of time or circumstance. And I think we have lived with the illusion from politicians, from government officials, from executives from BP, that they will be there until the last drop of oil is gone and the job is done. When you stand in front of the Gulf of Mexico and see its vastness and experience the power of what no human entity can control, whether it be in Washington or the Gulf or in Britain or anywhere else, you have to say, you know, when you say we'll do everything we can, in many ways, you can't do very much. There is a higher power at work here. And the Gulf will heal itself. The Gulf will get well. But not by and large, because of what human beings will do. And it is an illusion of control to say we will fix it. Just last week, two sets of scientists, one working for the U.S. government, one working out of the University of Georgia, tried to answer the same question. How much oil is left? Anywhere from, depending on who you listen to, 25% is all that's there anymore, to 80% is what's there. The truth, who knows? The illusion of control, we have a number. It's somewhere in between. By and large, we don't know where most of it is. We don't know what happened to most of it. But when you stand and experience the power of what a higher power has created, you come to believe and understand, and this is where it landed for us when we left last week. The Gulf will get better. The Gulf will heal itself. It will take a lot of time. And in the meantime, the rest of us, all of us, will suffer the consequences for the need we have to live our lives depending on oil as a source of energy. There is a higher power that will restore. When I was a kid, my dad and I used to play a little game. He would take my arm and put it in a hammerlock and would go, "Who's got the power?" And I would go, "I do," and he'd crank it a little higher, and I'd go, "I do," and then we'd, you know, and, "Oh, you do, Daddy, you've got the power." And it was a useful game in some ways because at the end of the day, I was grateful, relieved in a way, that there was someone in my life who was bigger than me and stronger than me and who loved me that had the power. And we still have one who is bigger and stronger and who loves us that has the power. So we don't have to be big on control. We don't have to seek to worship the idol, the illusion. For there is one Lord, thy God, who loves us and will restore us and keep us strong. Amen.